Accession number 10420, rule 4.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 4. War is very close now, Colonel. What memories have you of the mood of the time, particularly amongst the population?
I think most people realised that it was not going to be stopped. The situation had got too far for it to be stopped, and that Hitler would not climb down. And the war was imminent, and all the precautions had to be taken, such as your gas mask and your dugout and your all the precautions against war being brought to this country.
Was there? You say there was gas masks, of course, dugouts.
Yes.
Was the protection of buildings going on around you?
No, you couldn't very well protect the buildings. You couldn't. But entrances might be shored up with sandbags. But this is a very rural area here. And I don't think anybody really expected any bombing from the air or anything like that. It was more in the towns that that was anticipated. But there was an air of expectation and an air of fortitude, you might say. Well, if it's got to come, it's got to come, and we've got to do our best.
Your own personal feelings, were you excited by the thought of war?
I was certainly, I was anticipating it and very much, because one had done so much training for war, for mobilization and that sort of thing, that one really wants to see whether it did work.
Was it felt by yourself and others that the war would last a long time?
I think we did. I think we did. Especially as nothing happened for the first months or so till the time of Dunkirk. But we knew it would be severe, and we knew too that we'd have awful trouble from the air.
Did you, as a territorial soldier, have any knowledge of the state of the German armed forces before the war started?
I think we once had a conference at York. I cannot remember when it was, but we'd had a conference, a weekend conference at York. For the whole of the Northumbrian Division, north of perhaps the north of England, including Catterick, which we'd gone into the question of the possible German army, the strength of the German army.
And did you feel, or was the feeling prevalent, that it was strong?
Yes. You see, they'd been told they weren't allowed to have aeroplanes, and they'd started to build them in some force.
Did you have any knowledge of our own weakness as war came?
No, I don't think we realised where our weaknesses were. We just hoped that we'd get everything we could, and we got our supply of Bren guns and anti-tank guns, and we were made up to strength like that. But our vehicles were very, very weak.
Did you have any, what were your feelings about the result of the war, with yourself and your fellow officers and men?
Well, we always we always thought we'd win in the end. Might be a hell of a long time, but we'd go on until we couldn't go any longer.
Did you have a feeling that you would be emulating your father and his generation?
Oh yes, I certainly thought I was going to go out and do what my father did. I never realised, though, at the beginning of the war that I would do, in fact, exactly what he did, and commanded the battalion right through the Western Desert.
It's quite a unique achievement. Did you have feelings that you were fighting for king and country and
patriotism?
Yes,
we did.
Very
yes.
Strong?
And our families.
And you had no real dread of what might happen?
No, never dawned on me. And I knew when later I went to France, I'd have to, might not come back.
Again, thinking of the period between the wars, were the Germans still the baddies?
It started to fade away.
You didn't see anything that...
No. We did, as a small child, I remember that they were the baddies, but I didn't think at school or anywhere like that we ever considered the Germans were baddies by then.
Just before I come, or at least we come to talk about your time with the division... The division was changed into a motorized division, was it?
It was changed into a motorized division, and it had only two brigades, and it was supposed to have its own transport complete, and also a motorcycle battalion. So many motorcycles and sidecars, and that was commanded by Colonel Wood, whose brother was in the Durham Light Infantry. He was a fifth, and it was the fifth Fusiliers. It was the fourth territorial battalion of the Fusiliers. They were converted to motorcycles, and it was completely lost when we went to France.
About what time was did the change take place?
I think about 37.
And the commanding general at that time, do you recall his name?
The general, I can't remember when Martel came, but the general prior to Martel, the divisional commander, was General Herbert, who was the one I talked about when we went to France in 1934. And the duplicate division, which was the 23rd division, General Herbert was called back to command that.
General Martel, what are your memories of him?
How I got on with him? I got on with him extremely well. You've got to remember when war was about to be declared, and we were mobilizing, the senior officers of the staff, like the G1, who I think was called Hamilton, was a regular soldier, but had retired, and he was called back as a G1. Now the A and Q, who would be the man to whom I would refer everything in the division, and he would then go on to the general. He was the boss, you might say, of me and of Murray Grant, the DAQMG, was in fact an ex-territorial, and he had commanded, I think, a battalion of Middlesex Regiment, and he was, or had retired, the director of the savings bank. I mean, I can remember in peacetime seeing Donald Banks written on all standard letters from the post office savings bank. Now, he didn't come. Neither of them came immediately, and therefore Murray Grant and I had direct access to the general, and that prevailed slightly throughout my term, throughout the time I was at the DAAG, until I was brought back from France with congestion of the lungs. We could not stand Banks. I loathed the sight of him, and so did my good companion, Murray Grant, and so did the DAPM, the Deputy Assistant Provost Marshal, who was a fellow called, nicknamed Tiny Gill, and he was a huge, tall chap in the Royal Scots Fusiliers, a regular soldier. We just could not stand Banks.
What aspects of his...
He took the credit for everything. He wouldn't help you. And if you did anything, he took the credit. And we all called him the smooth performer. And when he eventually went, after I'd gone, but very shortly after he'd gone, I think people realised what sort of chap he was. But he went on, and I believe was a brigadier, and went in and was in command of flame warfare. Because when we get on further on, you'll see I've met him in the flame warfare demonstration. But it absolutely sickened us. The smooth performer, never accepted any responsibility, was rude at times, distinctly rude. Whenever he was out of the way, as he was, we always dealt direct with the general. Now, the general gave me all sorts of bits of advice. He, on one occasion, said to me, "Oh, Watson, do remember you're not a lawyer now." And on another occasion, he said, "Now look here, if higher authority say you can't do a thing, always remember you can. But if it's a physical impossibility, then it's not quite so easy." And then he once said to me, "Look here, Watson, if you want to do a thing and higher authority are forgetting about it, don't go and remind them about it, but just wait and let them forget, and then it's easier to do it yourself." And on another occasion he said to me, "Watson, when anything detrimental to the division that comes into your office, come and see me about it." And there was an occasion later when we were in Burford before we went to France. He called me into his office and he said, "Watson, I thought I told you that if anything detrimental came into the division, you had to come and see me." I said, "Yes, sir, that's perfectly true." Well, he said, "There's somebody coming down from the War Office to see Colonel Miller and your old battalion, the 6th Battalion, to try and recruit a tunnelling company in the Royal Engineers. Why haven't you told me about it?" And I said, "Well, sir, I'm frightfully sorry, but I know absolutely nothing about it." Well, he said, the general said, "Go and bring the officer, meet him at witness station, bring him here to lunch and put him back on the train again, but on no account let him go and see the 6th Battalion and Colonel Miller." And that was the sort of chap he was. He was frightfully loyal to you, but looking back on it, it was an extraordinary thing that here was five only in the division when war was declared, and the rest came in from all over, who had no idea about how the division was to run, and on top of it all duplicating. The divisional headquarters were duplicating.
So you went to the division in August of 1939.
39. I'd already done a fortnight. Now, the divisional headquarters was at a delightful little house called Harewood Hill in Darlington, behind rather Grange Road. And that's where the war started. But we soon moved into, I think it was called Grantland's, big house in Cunnicliffe Road. We moved in there, and it was from there we mobilised.
Can you tell me about mobilisation?
Yes. the order went out mobilized, just simply mobilized, and every unit had got its scheme prepared, just like we had at division headquarters. But the chaps that had been earmarked for the division headquarters all eventually came in. They didn't come in instantaneously, but as soon as they could, they had to make their, they were territorials, and of course the War Office had earmarked the more senior ones.
Do you recall the date of mobilisation?
No.
Do you recall the date of mobilisation?
No, I can't remember mobilisation, but there was a, of course, war was declared, and really you shouldn't, we didn't really mobilise till the 3rd of September, which was a Sunday. I think we'd, if I remember rightly, there were phases of mobilisation. There was phase one, phase two, mobilise. The key personnel were called up first in every battalion, and then finally the word mobilised went.
So what was the condition of divisional headquarters when you got there?
Slightly chaotic. Well, just an example, the clerks were civilians, and I think some of them did in fact in the end join up and become Royal Corps Signals. But we actually went to Burford, to our concentration area at Burford, with two typists, civilian girls, because I travelled all the way to Burford with one of them. And then when we had to go to France, we had to send them home. And most of the vehicles we had when we actually got to Burford were all impressed, any old kind of vehicle.
Such as?
You know, vans, civilian cars.
And how? And what kind of vehicle did you have for the troops to travel in as a motorised?
Well, we're supposed to have. We had 3-ton lorries for that, but I mean, staff cars were just ordinary car.
And how did you impress a car?
Well, the War Office would take, we'd say what we wanted, and it had to be left to the RAOC chap, Douglas, Colonel Douglas. He was the head chap in the RAOC, and I suppose he went round to the garages and said, we want this, we want this, we want this. I know when the King came to see us, there was a tatty old car at the back of the procession, which doctor was travelling in, and the police pushed it to one side and thought it was a civilian.
Right, what are your memories of those very early days with divisional headquarters?
Well, I tell you what was so splendid, the cooperation and the humour of it all. Everybody was as cooperative as they could be with one another, and there was always a great deal of humour. Now, the General's ADC was a chap called Jack Milbank, a great friend of mine, a contemporary at school, that lives down the road here, who was a farmer, and he was in the Green Hards. I think he'd been in the Territorials. You see, there'd been quite a rush to join the Territorial Army while this was going on. The general said to him, I cannot understand who would be a farmer year in, year out to his own ADC. But it was it really, we all cooperated awfully well. Now, the doctor, the head doctor, the ADMS, the divisional head doctor, was a well-known doctor in Newcastle, Errington, and the DADMS, Jim McCracken, who was also in the field ambulance, he was the deputy. He had a rare sense of humour, and he was a jock, and he couldn't stand Banks. the spoof's performer. He couldn't stand him. Neither could the ADMS. And he, Banks, was really the only nigger in the woodpile. Well, when the time did come, when I got congestions of lungs in France, McCracken sat up with me all night. And I think Gerrington did, the ADMS too.
What were your own responsibilities at headquarters?
At headquarters, doing with all with A matters, personnel. And one of the first things one did was to deal with applications from big firms and small firms for the return of their key personnel who joined up to their civilian life.
And you had a lot of this.
Oh, awful lot. Tremendous lot. You see all the Cleveland Bridge and Engineering Works, all the big engineering works, all in the north of England. And finally, I went to the general one day when Banks wasn't there, of course. He'd gone to France or something like that to prepare the way for us over there. And I said, look, sir, I'm terribly sorry, but there's this mass of applications for key personnel. And the general said, well, just leave them there, Watson, we're going to France on the 20th of January or whatever it was. Just leave them there. And as I say, they may still be there now in the old vicarage in Burford.
So you didn't lose many men back into industry?
No, I don't think so. We lost a few. And undoubtedly, they were key chaps, but they were loyal. They joined the territorials and so had to be called up.
They would be good quality.
They would be good quality, yes. Yes.
And General Martels would be quite angry about losing this
country. Oh, yes. He was. Yeah, General Martel was absolutely devoted to his division. And he was far happier commanding a territorial division for which he had the highest regard than he would have been if he'd been commanding a regular division. As a young man, he had come on a course, been sent on a course to Darlington Forge, and he had used all these great chaps who worked in the forge as sparring partners. But he was a great boxer. And when we had the divisional boxing championship in the drill hall in Marshfield Street in Darlington, there was always an exhibition bout between Sergeant Smith, or whatever his name was, and another, and it would be the divisional commander getting into the ring to show how boxing should be done. He had won every single weight in the army boxing except heavyweight, and he told me that he had lost that because he hadn't trained hard enough. He and I were once walking to divisional office in France, and a company quartermaster sergeant in the field ambulance saluted and said, "Good morning, sir," to the general. And the general turned to me and he said, "Where in the regular army would you find a company quartermaster sergeant or a sergeant major saying, 'Good morning, sir,' to his general?" And he was far, far happier commanding this North Country division, to which he was devoted, than any regular division.
You lost the Concert Battalion.
I lost what?
The Concert Battalion was turned into
Concert Company.
Concert Company was turned into a
anti-aircraft. Yes.
What was the constitution of the division? Of the battalions then? Yes.
But it was the same. I raised the Barnard Castle Company, B Company, in lieu of the company at Concert.
And they were still stationed in their main areas, Benimore, Crook, Bishop Auckland.
Still, yes, Barnard Castle. But there was Barnard Castle instead of Conchard.
Did you ever attend any lectures by Martel during this period of time? Because he was very much involved in getting the idea of a motorised division into the...
Yes. No, I don't think... I think, you know, there wasn't much time to attend lectures while mobilisation and the threat of mobilisation was taking place. Going to camp in Shilbottle was the first experience of motorised.
So when did you move from the northeast to your area?
In mid October, I think it was about mid October, the whole division went to the assembly area around Burford. Now, divisional headquarters was in the old vicarage at Burford, and the old vicarage at Burford is when you go down the street, the main street, it's on the left hand side at the bottom, the biggish building almost on the banks of the Windrush. The other the other places where the division were 150 Brigade, that was General Brigadier Cryer's division, was in Stow-on-the-Wold and Morton in the Marsh. The 151 Brigade was in the area of Chipping Norton under Brigadier Churchill, and then the Norfolk Yeomanry, which were sent to us as our anti-tank regiment, were in that absolutely charming place, Broadway. And the Royal Artillery and the Royal Engineers, if I remember rightly, were at Witney.
Do you recall the journey down? Do you recall the movement?
I motored down in my own car with this typist, with one of our female typists that we actually took with us. And we took two. And we hadn't got anybody else.
How were you received in the area?
Extremely well. What it was like at the end of the war after it was all over, or towards the end of the war, I don't know. But we were looked after extremely well. People were very kind. Somebody, I forget now who it was, well-known, he became a well-known judge, asked me if I'd like to go and shoot pigeons. And I went one day, certainly, it was not too shooting pigeons when I was down there, when I had the time. I was billeted in the golf club house at Burford, which was at the top of the village on the far side of the Oxford Cheltenham Road. It's since been pulled down for the purpose of making a roundabout at the top of the village. And divisional headquarters was in Berry Barns, an old tithe barn done up for dances and entertainments, and it still stands. And it has a notice even now, or had comparatively recently, to the effect that King George VI had had lunch there with the 50th officers of the headquarters, 50th Division, but I'll come to that later. Went on Christmas leave to stay when I was down there with some relatives of mine in Gloucestershire, and when I came back, Murray Grant said to me, he and I shared an office, that'll keep you quiet in the evening. I came back There's a great heap of papers on my desk. His Majesty's coming down to see the division before we go to France, and you'll be responsible for it. And I was entirely responsible for it. Of course, the AMQ, thank God, Banks had gone to France.
So you organised the full...
The whole thing.
Just before we come to that visit, obviously the battalions were camped around...
The 6th Battalion was at Chipping Norton, and some of the chaps were married there, and I believe there are one or two still live down there.